Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
Hi, everyone. It's Meghna Chakrabarty, and I've got a special On Point podcast drop for you. And that's because federal scrutiny of Boeing and its 737 MAX 9 aircraft is increasing. Following this month's in-flight blowout of a door plug on an Alaska Airlines flight, the Federal Aviation Administration has just issued a new statement saying the failure, quote, should have never happened and it cannot happen again. The FAA has also opened an investigation, and at the end of this week, the agency added that it will perform a complete audit of the 737 MAX 9's entire production line. Some engineers who used to work on the 737 MAX 9 production line say they are not surprised that the plane has had major problems.
Not at all. We weren't surprised at all.
Ed Pearson is a former manager at Boeing's factory. He's now with the Foundation for Aviation Safety, and he just spoke with Seattle's local TV station, KIRO7.
There's several root causes, and a lot of this obviously goes back to the two MAX crashes. I know this isn't reassuring to passengers. I mean, it's certainly not, you know, confidence-inspiring, but we have to admit these problems exist, meaning the company has to admit that all these issues are really real. They're brand new planes. They should not be having those kinds of problems.
When Pearson links the 737 MAX 9's current problems back to two deadly crashes that took place in 2018 and 2019, he's talking about underlying design, process, and management failures that many engineers say could have been avoided. Well, back in 2020, we had an in-depth conversation with another Boeing engineer and an aviation analyst about what's at the root of the safety issues plaguing the 737 MAX lines, both the 8 and 9. The conversation followed a series of intense federal hearings where Boeing corporate leaders testified about their company's safety records and standards. And in our show, the veteran Boeing engineer told us she would never board a 737 MAX again until Boeing makes even more changes to the aircraft than the company had thought necessary. So today, we're pulling that episode out of our archives and presenting it again to you, because we think it might help you understand what's led to Boeing's ongoing significant troubles with the 737 MAX, most recently with the MAX 9. So here's that episode from almost exactly 4 years ago, January 14th, 2020. From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A long time ago, when I was growing up in the Pacific Northwest, I was lucky enough to take one of the public tours of Boeing's manufacturing plant near Seattle. And let me tell you, it was awesome. To see these gravity-defying machines being assembled piece by piece, the thought, the technology, the care, pride, and attention to detail that went into the process, it was obvious to this then-young would-be engineer why people felt safe boarding a Boeing aircraft and why people felt proud to work at the company. Well, fast forward several decades to just last week, when more than 100 pages of internal electronic messages were released by Boeing to congressional investigators. They reveal a company culture broken down. Quote, "This plane was designed by clowns who were in turn supervised by monkeys," one employee writes of the 737 MAX. Another writes, "Would you put your family on a MAX simulator-trained aircraft? I wouldn't." Well, I want to know how this happened. Don't you want to know? I mean, how did an American manufacturing giant, once at the pinnacle of engineering excellence, devolve like this? As of yesterday, the company has a new CEO, so what is it going to take for him to turn Boeing around, and can he? So this hour On Point, we're going to get an engineer's inside view of Boeing. And you can join us. What questions do you have about the inner workings of Boeing, and what is it going to take for you to feel safe to fly on a 737 MAX aircraft again, if and when it ever gets cleared to fly? Well, Cynthia Cole joins us today from Bellevue, Washington. She worked at Boeing as an engineer for 32 years, from 1978 to 2010. And towards the tail end of that, she was the president of the Society for Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace, the union representing many Boeing engineers. She did that from 2006 to 2010. Cynthia, welcome to On Point.
Great. Thank you, Magda.
So I just want to give a tip of the hat to NPR's David Shaper, because we first heard your story in a terrific piece that he put together. And we have a link to David's piece at onpointradio.org. And we just wanted to hear more, because it sounded like that someone like you, who's got 3 decades of experience at Boeing, has a lot to teach the rest of us. So I'm wondering if you could just start at the beginning. When was your first day working as an engineer at Boeing, and what was it like?
So I had worked for another company before I came to work for Boeing. So I'd spent a year at Rockwell International working on the space shuttle. And I got laid off after a year. Then I went to work for Boeing at Edwards Air Force Base. And the difference in the attitude of the employees and the atmosphere and the work environment there was like night and day. People were happy to be there. We were all one big family. And it was, you know, the other work location, there would be people yelling at each other, cussing at each other. And at the Boeing company, there was no potty language. Everybody was happy to work together. And we would work out technical issues, and no one was afraid to ask questions. It was a great atmosphere. And the managers worked with us. They didn't, you know, lord over us. Uh-huh. And so it was a collaborative environment, and we solved technical issues.
Yeah, it sounded like it was kind of a dream job for a young engineer.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think, after getting laid off at the other company, I didn't think I'd last very long. And so I thought, okay, I'll give this a try for a while, and after that, I'll go find some other thing to do. And I ended up lasting for 32 years and never once getting laid off.
Wow. So when you first worked for Boeing at Edwards, I presume that was on military craft, but you eventually moved to Seattle to work on the passenger side of things, or the commercial aviation?
Okay. I was still working military aircraft.
Okay.
And then eventually I was working on the commercial derivatives that we use for our government. So there's a 747 that we call Air Force One. I worked briefly on that. And then there was a 757 called the C-32A. And that's what the vice president and the cabinet fly in. I was the lead test engineer on that program after the 911 upgrades. And then I was a systems engineer on the 737 version called the C-40. We have 3 of those.
Okay. So you were part of a team that was in charge of building the aircraft for the president and vice president.
Yes.
Okay.
It was great. I loved it. It was a great project.
Well, but so Cynthia, let me ask you, in that first decade, let's say, like when you were at work on a system or a project and something got flagged, there was a bug or a design flaw, how did Boeing deal with it? What was the process like?
The process was, well, I was, you know, like I had to sign off on paperwork before we flew. And if I wasn't ready, I didn't sign off. And then we had to fix those problems. Most of the time we were so proactive. I mean, my job, I was on call 24 hours a day because I was the mission data expert. And, I'd get calls at midnight. I just always left my phone on, and I would get calls at midnight if they were having a problem at shift change and they needed some expertise. And I mean, we just worked whenever we needed to. And I can tell you, even though we worked wild and crazy hours, we didn't always, you know, we just did it. We didn't have any attitude about it, because the most important thing was having a safe aircraft. Mm-hmm. And people worked together, and there would be disagreements, yet we would hash it out. You know, there was always this atmosphere of, let's get it to work. Let's figure out what's wrong. Let's solve the problems.
Yeah. And did you, so before you sort of rose to the higher levels that your career at Boeing took you to, who were your managers? Were they your fellow engineers?
They were always senior engineers that had decided they wanted to be managers, and they rose to the ranks, and they were always the technical experts. You know, I remember my chief engineer on the B-1 bomber program. He was amazing. He'd grown up in the Mojave Desert like I did, and he just was really different, and everybody looked up to him. If there was a problem, a technical problem, we would go into his office with our diagrams, and we would just kind of hash it out. He never really told us the answer. That was one of the things I really admired about him. He would lead us to think about how to solve the problem. So he was always training the next generation of engineers to be even better.
Wow.
So yeah, I loved him. He was great. He was just great.
So I mean, so here's the thing. Oh, you know, I'm still thinking back to when I was a kid and I took the tour of the Boeing plant, which I really, yeah. It was super awesome. Amazing. But I just, a lot of companies say, like, we put safety first and our number one priority is, like, excellence in the products that we send out, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of what they do on the manufacturing floor, it might be different. But it wasn't like that at Boeing. So tell me, like if there was a safety issue, for example, that came up, like, what was the standard that the engineers had to clear for you to feel like you could sign off on it? Because you said it wouldn't go forward unless you signed off.
Yeah, well, I knew my own job, so I knew what I needed to do. And so on the military programs, we had incredible quality control. In fact, if there had ever been any incident on any of those aircraft, we would have known every single part by part number, serial number, and part number of any piece on that aircraft. We had such meticulous records. And so, yeah, I knew what had to be done and what was right for my part of the aircraft, and so did the other engineers. And during those days at the Boeing company, safety and doing it right and getting all of your, you know, we had incredible process, incredible procedures. You know, systems engineering at the Boeing company was like no place else I've ever been. And we had to document. If you couldn't document your process step by step, you didn't have a process. And that was one of the things that made the Boeing company so excellent, was the systems engineering. And so, you know, we always thought, you know, schedule and cost, you know, any profits, mm-hmm. and staying on track, that would follow if you did the job right. The most important thing was doing the job right. And then the profits would come. And everybody had that mindset.
Wow. So profits would follow engineering excellence.
Exactly. People would have confidence in what we were building. The Air Force, in fact, one of my Air Force friends from Edwards Air Force Base ended up going to the Pentagon. And the story he told when he came back, because we had bid on a couple of projects, and he said the word on the street was, if you want it done right the first time, Boeing gets the bid. If you want it done less expensively to fit in your fiscal year and then fix it later to get it to work, then you then somebody else would win the bid. And he said they always wanted, you know, Boeing always had the bid that was accurate. We didn't undercut our bids. We knew what it costs to build an aircraft or to build a new system. And that's what he said. If you want it done right the first time, you get the Boeing company to do it.
Cynthia, this is blowing my mind, I have to say, because, I mean, the emails that I quoted from that were just written in 2018 by Boeing employees speak of a company culture that's completely different from you're describing. When did it all start changing?
It was after the McDonnell Douglas merger. It was during that time, and heritage Boeing engineers were shocked. We were appalled. We fought it. I mean, that was part of the reason for our 40-day strike. I was a picket captain out on the strike, and that was part of the reason. The McDonnell Douglas group in management, they wanted to break our union, and it was really funny because we weren't really known as a strong union until they forced that strike, and we ended up winning. Okay. It was funny because the strike happened over $25 million in benefits, and they took our offer and tossed it off the table. And we even had a mediator in there from federal mediation, and he eventually gave up trying to come back and forth, and he gave up. And he said, here's the thing. I don't know how your company is going to continue to exist. You've got your heritage Boeing managers, who he called the Boy Scouts. And then you have the McDonnell Douglas manager, who he called the hunter-killer assassin.
Cynthia, hang on here for a second because we have to take a quick break, and we'll talk more about when, where, and why that McDonnell Douglas merger happened when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're getting the inside view this hour of how the company culture at Boeing changed so dramatically over the course of many decades that led to the disasters with the 737 MAX aircraft. I'm joined today by Cynthia Cole. She worked at Boeing as a test and system engineer for 32 years. She retired in 2010. And Cynthia, just before the break, your line was breaking up a little bit. You said that after the McDonnell Douglas merger, when Boeing merged with McDonnell Douglas in about 1996, someone had said something about the difference between Boeing managers and McDonnell Douglas managers. Can you just say that again? Because it was a little hard to hear.
Sure. It was during our negotiations when we had our strike in 2000. They called in a federal mediator because we weren't making any headway. Both sides were kind of dead in the water. And that's when they bring in a federal mediator. And so this guy was going back and forth between the SPIA side and the management side, trying to broker a deal. And he finally came back to the SPIA side and said, you guys are going to have a strike. I cannot make any headway. And then he added, I don't understand how your company will continue to exist because you've got two different management structures at war and they're just over in that next room. And he called the heritage Boeing managers the Boy Scouts. And then he called the new crop, the McDonnell Douglas people, he called them the hunter-killer assassins.
Wow.
And they were the ones that actually were calling the shots, and they're the ones who forced the strike.
And this was the federal mediator who said this.
Right, the federal mediator from Washington, D.C. And it's interesting because that strike, over $25 million, cost the Boeing company $750 million.
Huh. Wow.
Yeah, we won.
And SPIA is just to remind people, that's the Society of Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace that you were the president of for a couple of years. Okay. So
later on, I was president for 2 terms for 4 years, yes.
About 6 years after this that we're talking about.
Right.
Okay. So hang on here for a second, Cynthia, if you could, because I want to now introduce into the conversation Leon Grunberg. He's joining us from Tacoma, Washington. Leon's professor emeritus of sociology and anthropology at the University of Puget Sound and co-author of Turbulence, Boeing and the State of American Workers and Managers, and Emerging from Turbulence, Boeing and Stories of the American Workplace Today. Professor Grunberg, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you.
What was it about this McDonnell Douglas merger in 1996 that so profoundly changed, or quickly changed, the company culture at Boeing?
Yeah, that's the key question, I think. As Cynthia mentioned, they brought in a cutthroat culture with a new vision and a new ethos. The two primary shareholders were John McDonald, one of them McDonnell Douglas, and Harry Stonecipher, who was the CEO of McDonnell Douglas. So they became the largest shareholders, and essentially a lot of the top executives were imported from McDonnell Douglas. And what's really interesting is that in 2004, Stonecipher, who then became CEO of Boeing, actually made it very explicit that the intention was to change the culture. He said, that was my intention. When people say, I changed the culture, that was the intention. So it's run, and this is a quote, so it's run like a business rather than a great engineering company.
Now, so that's exactly the opposite of what Cynthia said was the hallmark of Boeing's culture before that.
Exactly. He inverted the priority, if you like, so that the sort of, as a lot of employers told us, the bean counters, the finance guys, became the dominant people in the company. The ethos was to sort of chase shareholder value above everything. And that became the sort of, that trickled down across the whole management ranks, and that became the sort of dominant paradigm. And it led to a whole bunch of effects that we can talk about.
Well, let's talk about that in a second, but I guess I should first ask, why? Why did Harry Stonecipher do this? Because was the presumption that Boeing wasn't profitable beforehand or not profitable enough? I mean, what was his motivation?
Yeah, I think the latter. It was a lot, you know, obviously some people thought that Boeing wasn't profitable enough. And the GE culture that actually spawned people like Harry Stonecipher, excuse me, and another CEO, McNerney, and so on, really was to try and sort of squeeze the costs out of production and to try and maximize shareholder value. And they could always find ways to cut costs and to drive efficiency to try and increase profits. I think the merger occurred, and by the way, you know, people I spoke to at the time, well, since and at the time, were against it. Some of the top Boeing members, but Phil Condit, who was the CEO of Boeing at that time, thought it was a good idea. Partly too, they were really interested in the McDonnell Douglas defense side of the business, and that would help strengthen Boeing's, you know, diversify a little bit because the airplane business was cyclical. And so defense would be a counter to that. And they also would, of course, take over a competitor. But as Ron Woodard, who was the president of Boeing Commercial at the time, said, you know, they had McDonnell Douglas was doing very badly in the marketplace, you know, competitively. The DC-10 was having a lot of trouble. So really, they ended up spending quite a lot of money buying a company that was failing on its commercial side.
Interesting. Now, just to take a step back here for a second, you said the GE culture. I mean, is that sort of the Jack Welch view of trying to the financialization of manufacturing?
Exactly. Okay. And it actually spread. It's amazing the power he had. I think the current CEO, who's just taken over yesterday, is also a GE product. So he spread his wings far.
So, Cynthia, How did you see, what was the first, I mean, you talked about the strike that happened in 2000, but what was the, in terms of like what was actually happening on the manufacturing floor or in, you know, in the systems groups, like how did you start seeing the company change in tangible ways?
Well, I was working on the Joint Strike Fighter at the time of the merger, and we were working, you know, we had brought some of the St. Louis McDonnell Douglas workers, engineers, to Seattle, and I was working with them, and this is before the merger took place, and they were excited because they did not like McDonnell Douglas. They didn't like the culture. They said it was cutthroat. It didn't value engineering expertise, and they were so excited about coming to work for the Boeing company where they could finally get to do their job right. And I'm sure they ended up being very disappointed. We started seeing our processes. First, it was more human resources and those kind of processes being taken over by the McDonnell Douglas process. And people were fighting it. And it was almost as if this was a failed strategy of Stonecipher and his ilk. And they wanted to prove that they were right by doing it over again. And it's like, it's insanity to do the same thing over and over again, that the same failed process over and over. But they wanted to prove that they were right, that this would work. And McDonnell Douglas was nearly bankrupt by the time the merger happened. And the employees that came over from St. Louis, they were in shock. They said, no, this is a bad company. You don't want to take on our process. You know, make us like you.
Wow.
So it's that tangible. And yeah.
So, did you had said earlier that, for example, you were talking about how amazing one of your supervising managers was, and that, you know, for you, for people working under you, they could call you at any time, day or night, if an issue came up. I mean, were those sort of norms? Did they start changing at Boeing? Because in some of the documents that have been recently released, we see people engineers complaining that their managers just no longer had the same kind of experience they once did.
Exactly. I've talked to a few of my friends. In fact, one of them was a senior safety engineer with me on the same program where I was the lead test engineer on the C-32A. And she just retired last week. She was just counting the days. And she said, my new manager is decades younger than I am and doesn't have the technical expertise in safety, doesn't know safety. And she's all about tracking schedule and budget. And she just thinks the technical problems will solve themselves. And I've heard that comment from several of my friends who are still there that are engineers. It's all about schedule and budget, and they just assume the technical issues will work themselves out eventually. Well, it's kind of like the backward way of doing it. You focus on the safety and the technical issues, and then the schedule and budget will follow.
Hmm.
And again, the McDonnell Douglas model.
So, Professor Grunberg, are there other aspects of how Boeing as a company changed that are worth noting now in terms of how we understand where Boeing has ended up today?
Yeah, I think so. I think a good way to sort of see the practical effects of the change is to look at a couple of airline programs. So contrast how the 777 was built and launched, and how the 787 was the business model for the 787. And the 777 took 5 years to build. It was launched in 1995. It was about $5 billion in cost. It's one of the safest planes. They had a working together philosophy that Cynthia's been talking about. They created what were called design build teams, where engineers and manufacturing workers were co-located, so they would discuss problems as they arose from the design and then the manufacturing aspect. So and apparently, amazing, there were 10,000 people working on that program. Alan Mulally, who was the head of that program, would bring all together the 10,000 people that worked on that program three or four times a year to avoid sort of silos so people could talk and communicate to each other. Now, you contrast that with a 787, which was the new plane, the Dreamliner, that was initially designed in 2003. That took 8 years. It was over three years late. At this point, I think at one point it was like $32 billion, so way over cost, overruns. It had a grounding of a few months because of battery problems. And so it's really ironic because it was based, why did that happen? Why was the 787 business model a sort of flawed model? Mm-hmm. Was that Boeing completely outsourced a lot of the key parts of the plane, including wings, which were, as one general manager told us, that were the crown jewels of the sort of Boeing production line. And so they outsourced a lot of stuff to the subcontractors, and they lost what they call configuration control of the supply chain. And they did that partly to try and minimize costs and to share risks with these subcontractors, with these partners. And, of course, the sad irony is, as I've just said, the decision to do that, to minimize risk and minimize cost, ended up doing exactly the opposite. You had huge cost overruns and delays and a lot of risk in the building of the plane. And that's something you see develop with a 737 MAX 2.
Wow. Well, you know what? Let's just get a couple calls in here because there are a lot of people who have interesting perspectives on this. So Leon and Cynthia, stand by for just a moment. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Simsbury, Connecticut. Jim, you're on the air. With us, Jim? Okay, we'll try to get Jim back. Let's go to Kathy, who's calling from Quicksburg, Virginia. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Listening while I was waiting has really opened my eyes to what I was about to say. I grew up in the Houston area close to NASA, so I grew up in that area. I worked for Southwestern Bell AT&T. That was the first time I ever heard the phrase, good enough for government work. Well, I mean, you know, we didn't slough or, you know, have bad products, but I kept hearing this, good enough for government work. Once I got working at NASA as a contractor, I saw it in action. Good enough for government work. Not, you know, prime, not great, but good enough. So now I'm listening to the McDonnell Douglas. Well, that was one of our biggest contractors. Mm-hmm. So I'm afraid that this attitude has spread into everything now.
Huh. Well, Kathy, thank you so much for your call and your reflections there as one time being inside of NASA. Let's go to Jim. Let's see if we got Jim now from Simsbury, Connecticut. Jim, you're on the air.
You got me, and thanks for that and for this program. I wanted to mention that there is a natural tendency among humans to try and push their luck, perhaps more so in the aerospace industry than in other things, because you're basically doing things that haven't been done before. There's also a natural tendency in a profit-making organization between the people who want to spend the money to do it right and the managers who always say, you can't spend that much and it'll take too long. These things are all part of the way everybody does business, but perhaps more so in something really important like the aerospace industry. Mm. Personalities come into it in terms of, some people are stronger at pushing their case than others.
Yeah.
Definitely the difficulties among all these things are when the dollars or bottom line come into it. But how do you go ahead and be pretty sure you're going to make a profit?
Yeah.
So the aerospace engineer, and Cynthia was pointing this out, is really in the middle in many things. Additionally, the way the aerospace industry works is that the FAA can't possibly have all the expertise to understand everything on such a complex machine.
Right.
And so they have to trust people. And these people, who are called DERs, designated engineering representatives, then act as the eyes and ears of the FAA from a technical perspective because of their specific understanding.
Jim, I'm going to take it back from you there for two reasons. One, we have to take a quick break here, and I appreciate you pointing out the FAA needing to rely on internal experts for a kind of form of self-regulation in the aviation industry. We've actually done a couple of shows about exactly that issue and the positives and the pitfalls of that. Head over to onpointradio.org to go back and listen to those shows. But when we come back, we'll talk more about how to now turn Boeing's company culture back around. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the devolution of company culture inside of Boeing and how that contributed to the two catastrophes with the 737 MAX aircraft. We're getting an inside view of how Boeing changed over the past 30 years or so. I'm joined today by Cynthia Cole. She worked at Boeing as a test and system engineer for 32 years. She retired from the company in 2010. Leon Grunberg also joins us. He's a professor emeritus of sociology and anthropology at the University of Puget Sound, co-author of two books about Boeing, including Turbulence, Boeing and the State of American Workers and Managers. And joining us now from Washington is Lori Aratani, transportation reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us last to discuss Boeing in March, shortly after the second Boeing 737 MAX crash in Ethiopia. Lori, it's great to have you back.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so as of yesterday, Boeing has a new CEO in Dave Calhoun. Has he said anything so far about what he's going to do to change the culture at Boeing?
Boeing is hoping for a fresh start with Calhoun coming on board this week. He sent out, on his first day, an email to employees talking about opportunities for the company to be better, much better than it is. He talked about the importance of transparency internally with its customers, and he talked about a recommitment to safety. Now, this echoes a lot of what the previous CEO, who was fired in December, talked about in the wake of the crash. Boeing has really tried to change things, but as you can hear from Cynthia and from Professor Grunberg, it sounds like a pretty tall order. The culture that McDonnell Douglas brought in, you know, it sounds like it's taken hold. You can see it in these emails that were released last week. Cynthia talked about friends who talked about supervisors whose main focus is on schedule and budget. So Calhoun really is going to have a tall order. His main focus is going to be to get this Boeing 737 MAX back up in the air.
Right. So I want to ask you about that, right? Because his contract includes a $7 million bonus if he gets the 737 MAX flying again. I mean, on the one hand, that could be great incentive for the company to turn things around, but could it also be a perverse incentive?
You know, and it's interesting that you say that, because yesterday three Democratic senators, Senator Markey of Massachusetts, Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut, and Senator Tammany Baldwin of Illinois wrote a letter to Boeing's board of directors saying, don't do this. You can't do this, because it creates the same incentives for corporate behavior that they believe got Boeing where it is today with the MAX program.
Now, Calhoun was on the board for years, right?
Yeah. Calhoun is not new to Boeing necessarily. He's been on the board for 10 years. He's got a background, as Professor Grunberg mentioned, at GE. He spent some time at GE. He spent some time at Nielsen. And he spent some time at Blackstone. He's seen as someone who is turnaround, very action-focused, but also someone that may have a lot of what Jack Welch and that sort of GE culture brought to management.
Okay, so Professor Grunberg, let me turn back to you for a second, because I suppose a CEO can turn around a balance sheet, I don't know, a couple quarters, a couple of years here, but turning around a culture is something entirely different.
Right. It's a whole mindset and then the behaviors that go into it. So it's not just me. You've got to have a different vision. I think he has to spell out the fact that he wants to return Boeing to its engineering excellence vision. But then he has to implement that by developing incentives and performance measures that actually change the balance back towards safety and quality rather than to schedule and minimizing costs and speed of delivery. So that's really what he has to do. And that might lead to a short-term hit on profits and the share price, but that's, to me, that's the surest way for Boeing to regain its reputation for safety. And in a sense, you know, if you look at the two self-inflicted wounds that have happened with the 787 and then the 737 MAX, which have cost billions and billions of dollars, it's probably the best way to be financially successful in the longer term rather than in the short term. So hopefully that lesson has been taken in by the Boeing leaders. But additionally, I think it's important perhaps for Calhoun to be sort of an interim CEO. He's in his early 60s. He's been, as someone just said, that he's been on the Boeing board. I think he knows the company, but he's part of that history. So he could maybe get them over this kind of hump, and then they should bring in someone perhaps who has aerospace engineering knowledge, who is put people on the board, change the board up, the board of directors. It's really interesting that the two highest paid people in Boeing was the CEO, which is not surprising, but the second highest was the CFO, the chief financial officer. You know, maybe the chief engineer should also be highly paid.
Well, so Lori, let me turn back to you about something here, because I just want to read a couple of these lines from some of these emails that were released last week here, because there, you know, we can talk about getting a culture of sort of engineering excellence back, but there's more that's revealed, right? I mean, there's a February 2018 email where someone writes, "Would you put your family on a MAX simulator trained aircraft? I wouldn't." Someone else writes, "Not sure I'll be returning in April given this. Am not lying to the FAA. We'll leave that to the people who have no integrity." Someone else writes, "I'll be shocked if the FAA passes this turd." I mean, these are a small number of emails in a company which, you know, millions of such of messages are sent. So we're not going to disparage every Boeing employee here. But the point I'm trying to make here, Lori, is that it's not just an engineering issue. There's almost a culture of deceit here that seems to be revealed in some of these emails.
You can see that there's clearly pressure to meet schedule. There was a whistleblower who testified before the House Transportation Committee, which is doing its own investigation of the certification process and these issues surrounding the 737 MAX, that talked about production issues at the Renton, Washington facility where the 737 MAXs were built. They couldn't get parts on time. People who weren't qualified to be doing the work were doing work, and it just sounded like a culture that was so completely different than the one that Cynthia joined when she started as a very young engineer.
And so what are you hearing from members of Congress, from the FAA? I mean, what are they going to do next here?
Well, members of Congress are very angry. They're very disturbed. Peter DeFazio, who chairs that House committee that's been really aggressively investigating this and getting these documents, has talked about changing. I think one of the callers, Jim, mentioned this relationship between FAA and these companies, and perhaps pulling back some of that authority to FAA to strengthen oversight. You know, the problem is that industry pays a lot more than the government pays. So they already have trouble recruiting. So that's going to be a significant challenge. But I think Congress really wants to look at ways that they can put more safeguards here. You know, the 737 MAX is one of the issues, but the real test is going to be what happens with the process for future airplanes. The MAX, you know, they'll get the MAX back up flying. There's so much scrutiny now, but what happens when all the attention goes away?
Well, Lori Aretani, transportation reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Waterbury, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. So up until about 5 years ago, I had a terrible fear of flying, so much, you know, that it would give me anxiety just driving someone to the airport. And I've since taken a job that is that I have to fly constantly. And so I had to sort of abandon that fear. I knew it was an irrational fear. And I abandoned that, and it was sort of all predicated on the fact that I placed my trust in all of the systems and people involved in the process to get me onto a plane and then safely back on the ground. And now this trust has been betrayed, and I've got like 100 flights coming up. And these are just the emails that we see from just one company that's having problems. I mean, I can't believe that this is not systemic in an entire, in the whole industry, that, you know, cutting corners to save costs. I mean, that's just seems to be out of the playbook recently for every company. There's no long-term thinking and putting profits ahead of people.
Mark, thank you so much for your call. Let me turn back to Cynthia Cole on this. As someone who worked in the industry for many decades, is Mark wrong about these practices being across aviation? I mean, how could you put him at his ease?
Well, right now, he is not far from the truth, and it breaks my heart. It really does. And we were fighting this before I retired. This ceding to Boeing engineers a lot of the tasks of the FAA. And, you know, the safety engineer I was telling you about, she and I were fighting this tooth and nail. And we lost that battle. And a lot of the FAA tasks were given over to the Boeing engineers that wanted to do it and save time and not have to explain it all to people they thought were less than them. And that just, again, if you can't write it all down, you don't have a process. If you can't explain it to an FAA engineer, then you're not doing your job and it's not good enough. And in my dream world to save the Boeing company, it would be to bring Alan Mulally back to the top of the company and put him in charge of riding the ship of the Boeing company. I think he's the only one who could do it.
What would he do that would solve this problem?
I would put him in the place of that Jack Welch guy that
Calhoun.
They just put in, the new CEO. Yeah, instead of Calhoun, put in Alan Mulally. He should have gotten the job in the first place and not Jim McNerney. Alan Mulally loves Boeing products. He's loyal. He always has been. And the only reason he went to Ford was he wasn't put at the top of the Boeing company. And so I would bring him back. I'd bring him back in a heartbeat.
Looks like we might have lost Cynthia's line. We'll try to get her back here.
Sorry, are you talking to me?
No, I was talking to Cynthia, but Professor Grunberg. Actually, let me ask you a question, because I think a couple of minutes ago you said something that that really caught my attention, that in order to turn Boeing around for the long run, they may have to make some decisions that might sacrifice or reduce profitability in the short run.
Right.
My question is, given the nature of American business right now, do you think Boeing's shareholders, Boeing's board, would have tolerance for that? Because I heard you say earlier, it takes years to rebuild a company culture.
Yeah. Well, I think they just have to insulate themselves from the pressure of the Wall Street. I know that's hard, but I think if they step back a little bit and think about the self-inflicted wounds, as I pointed out, of the two business models that they've used, 787 and 737 MAX, which was rushing it to market so they could meet the challenge from Airbus's 320neo, and to avoid having pilots get additional training on the sim, which ironically now Boeing says every pilot, even if they've flown 737s for years, have to do. I think you know, they'll just have to sort of, in a sense, insulate themselves from that Wall Street pressure if it comes from the shareholders, and really rebuild the company from the ground up. All the testing and retesting that when we were interviewing Boeing workers talked about, all the built-in redundancy in all the products and parts they made, you know, always having backups, the inspections, you know, the pride that workers took, even disillusioned ones that we saw a lot of disillusionment after the merger, they still kind of held to the fact that Boeing had a really sterling safety record. That has to be rebuilt. How you do it, you know, I think Mullally could do it, or someone like Mullally could do it, but it has to come from a vision, and then implementing the sort of performance, as I said, the incentives and the reward structures that encourage that behavior all down the line. And I think one other thing I'd like to say is that they have to start listening to the employees who know intimately what's happening in the workplace, you know, and what we see from the emails and previous investigations by the Seattle Times and so on is that they weren't listening. You know, they were ignoring them or sitting on them, burying them, and they were warned about some of these things early, just like with the 787. They were warned that some of this business model was going to create chaos, and they didn't listen. So I think they have to start taking seriously the comments and the experiences of the shop floor and the designers and the technicians that work at Boeing.
It also sounds like the company is going to have to be willing to slow down, right? Because a lot of the pressures were coming from keeping on production timetables. Now, listen, Cynthia, I hope we have you back here. We've just got a minute and a half left. Okay, I'm so sorry about that. We have a minute and a half left, and I want to know if and when the 737 MAX is certified to fly again, will you step on board a MAX airplane?
Well, I believe they should recertify that entire aircraft, because there's more than just the system that's made the news. They've got engine changes. They've got so many changes. This is really a brand new aircraft. They should recertify the entire thing.
Does that mean that are you not going to be willing to fly the MAX?
No, not unless they do unless I know they've done the right thing and put the engineers in charge, and Boeing engineers say, yes, we've done everything we can do, and we verify, you know, we say this is a good aircraft. And I don't know if Calhoun's in charge. I really don't see how that's going to happen, because he's not going to do anything different than they've been doing. I really don't see him doing anything differently.
Wow. Well, Cynthia Cole, speaking to us today from Bellevue, Washington. She worked at Boeing as a test and system engineer for 32 years, retired in 2010. Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, you are welcome.
And Leon Grunberg, professor emeritus of sociology and anthropology at the University of Puget Sound, co-author of a couple of books about Boeing, including Turbulence, Boeing and the State of American Workers and Managers. Professor Grunberg, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.